History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme...
It is actually the dawn of modern electioneering.
With the election of 1918, there was a great change in the feeling of the country. We now had a government.
100 years ago this month, Ireland experienced the most extraordinary Westminster election results since the last great extension of the franchise in 1884.
In his first reference really to the election, he said, "All of us here were delighted with the good news of last Wednesday's promising start. As you say, of course, it's not the men, but the cause that's winning."
She was very clear about her vision for the future, and she didn't really compromise on that in the least in her election approach.
Widespread revulsion at the 1916 executions, as well as the anger at the attempt to introduce conscription to this country, resulted in a landslide general election victory for Sinn Féin.
There would have been a degree of trepidation as to what was going to happen next and what were they going to do with this mandate.
It was a crucial moment in our history. Tonight on the programme, we look at the story of the election in Ireland, the campaign, the voting and the aftermath, and the reasons for the shifting dynamics in Irish politics and society. I'm joined in studio by three guests: Elaine Callanan, lecturer in modern Irish history at Carlow College; Dermot Ferriter is professor of modern Irish history at University College Dublin; Mary Muldowney is Dublin City Council historian in residence. You're all very welcome indeed. Elaine, first election since 1910, first where some women, and we emphasise some women, could vote. Was it the first where the Irish Parliamentary Party, which had dominated politics for decades in Ireland, faced any real opposition?
Well, they would have faced opposition in times past because they would have contested against unionists, largely now in the Ulster constituencies and in areas of Dublin. But we also forget that they contested against each other after the Parnell split. And in those instances, there would have been some very bitter elections fought. So they were fairly well versed in terms of competing, but the message was always the same because both sides were, you know, talking about the Home Rule message, unless, of course, they were against unionists. In which case it was unionism versus home rule. But they, at times past, they would have had good competition.
But not as monolithic as they used to be, because you had things like, you know, William O'Brien's, the All for Ireland Party, which were kind of splinter groups, really, weren't they, of the Irish Parliamentary Party?
Yes, and largely in the Cork area, you would have had William O'Brien. It was the first time, perhaps, that they faced a nationalist party in 1918 that had a different message and a different approach to Ireland going forward in the future. And in that then, Home Rule, which was getting old as a message as well because it had been shelved for the duration of the war, it was now going to go up against some fresh thinking in terms of abstention from Westminster and appealing to the Paris Peace Conference instead of the Imperial Parliament.
Mary, the electorate had been massively expanded. Everybody thinks in terms of women getting the vote, but there would have been actually far more men who had never voted before, who were now able to vote. Wouldn't that be the case?
Yeah, it was universal male suffrage over 21 after the Representation of the People Act, whereas it wasn't, of course, the same for women. They had to be over 30 and they still, there was a property qualification. So there was about, I think it was 53 roughly percent of the potential female population who could actually vote and who did during the 1918 election.
Chairman, the war was over. World War I had just ended, but the conscription crisis would still, I would imagine, have been fresh in people's memories.
Well, there's no doubt about that. And I mean, in early 1918, Sinn Féin wasn't necessarily super confident, and there was some contemporary comment on the idea that they might have peaked, that there was a degree of apathy setting in. And what really re-energises the volunteers on Sinn Féin, of course, is the threat to impose conscription. That's not just relevant to Sinn Féin, it's relevant to the Irish Parliamentary Party as well, the Catholic Church, the Labour movement, and women are very active in protesting against conscription as well. So it builds an extraordinary alliance, but it's Sinn Féin that benefits most from that. And they use the message throughout the election. I mean, the conscription crisis is at its height in April 1918, but it still resonates by the end of the year. It really did electrify the volunteers, and they were the words of Liam Deasy in Cork when he was talking about the concern in early 1918 that there wasn't an awful lot for the Irish volunteers to be doing, but suddenly they had this focus. And it certainly finds its way into the election. One of the dominant themes for Sinn Féin during the election is the idea that parliamentarianism is useless. And parliamentarian itself becomes a term of abuse. And Arthur Griffith of Sinn Féin mocks the Irish Parliamentary Party for having belatedly converted to abstention during the conscription crisis, because they actually leave the House of Commons in protest and make common cause with the rest of those who are protesting. And that was flung back in their faces as well, because, of course, a key platform for Sinn Féin in 1918 is abstention. And abstention is a novelty, and it needs to be explained to an electorate and a new electorate. And one of the arguments that was made by the Irish Parliamentary Party, of course, is we've achieved so much by being at Westminster. They went right back to the late 1870s, look at all the reforms we got in relation to land and housing and education and pensions and welfare. And they're making the strong case, as they see it, that Parliament is where you can get results. But what's clear by the end of 1918 is that the focus has shifted completely away from Parliament, and the Irish Parliamentary Party don't have a response to that.
We're going to hear from the RTE archives now the voice of Liam O'Brien, who was Sinn Féin candidate in the constituency of Mid Armagh. And here he describes what candidates spoke about at public meetings.
Many other speakers that I knew of at the time stressed mainly in their speeches to public meetings the right of Ireland to self-determination, according to the 14 points laid down by President Wilson, who said that all nations, small and weak, as well as great and strong, were entitled to decide upon their own form of government. That was our plank. The issue we put to the people was to forget all petty local issues, to vote for the candidate who stood for that, no matter who he was or where he came from, no matter what he was like individually, and to form a big body, a unanimous call to the peace conference to allow Ireland to decide its own fate.
Now, interesting reference there, Jeremy, to Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, the Paris Peace Conference. Sinn Féin did hold out hope of getting some recognition at that conference. They wanted to kind of hold Woodrow Wilson to his word.
Oh, absolutely. This theme of self-determination, Sinn Féin built an awful lot of other rhetoric around that and what it should mean in practice. And it's not just about Ireland, this election. It's a watershed for all sorts of other reasons. It comes at the end of the war. The war has changed everything, and it has transformed politics and psychology, and has also shifted a lot of attention onto borders and how they might be decided. New dispensations, you know, carving up the wreckage, essentially. And Sinn Féin wants to make the case, as representatives of Irish sovereignty, to make the case for self-determination in the way that Wilson has promised the post-war order will be solved. The difficulty, of course, for Wilson is that he also has to take cognizance of what David Lloyd George wants as British Prime Minister. And he's intent, obviously, on, as he sees it, not so much political peace in Ireland as political unity in Europe. And that political unity has to involve their interests being adhered to. And that includes, of course, as they would see it, the maintenance of their empire. So Wilson doesn't follow through on this. The way in which self-determination is defined by Wilson eventually is that it'll only be self-determination insofar as it does not affect vital strategic interests for his allies, including, of course, Britain.
Elaine, let's look at some of the straws in the wind between 1916 and 1918. There were a number of by-elections in the lead-up to the 1918 general election. Mixed results, though, for Sinn Féin.
Mixed results. They were very successful in the early by-elections, and certainly, you know, it all started with North Roscommon. Now, Count Plunkett, who was the candidate in North Roscommon, wasn't strictly speaking just a Sinn Féin candidate. He was nominated by others. But it certainly gave the impetus for this idea of nominating candidates that were linked to Sinn Féin, and if at all possible, had been involved in the 1916 rising in some way. So it gives them a sort of ideas, North Roscommon, which they carry out then through to the other by-elections of that time, primarily South Longford and East Clare. And in South Longford, of course, they come up with their put him in to get him out campaign, which was the poster with the prisoner. And the idea was put him into politics to get him out of jail. So those by-elections were very successful for Sinn Féin until we go up into Ulster. And then we see the tide turning in favour of the Irish Parliamentary Party. So you can see from that really that the concerns in Ulster were slightly different. And maybe ideas like abstention from Westminster and Republic were just a touch too far for Ulster people. And of course, the other area where the Irish Parliamentary Party were extremely successful was Waterford City, but that was a big Redmond stronghold.
Dermot's 21-somethings who could now vote, were young people getting actively involved in politics at this stage?
Well, there's no doubt about that. I mean, if you look at the contemporary police reports from the Royal Irish Constabulary, a lot of them are commenting on the idea that this is a very youthful election, and there's definitely a generational issue going on. The Irish Parliamentary Party was an aged party. The average age of an Irish Parliamentary Party MP in the 1880s was 40. It's now 55. In contrast, you know, Sinn Féin is looking like a very youthful party, and many of its candidates are very young. And again, the novelty that's working there in relation to people actively engaged in elections and electioneering. This was something new, and the volunteers embrace it wholeheartedly.
Actually going out looking for votes.
Exactly. There's a very amusing story that Michael Laughlin has told about Swift McNeill in Donegal, who was the Irish Parliamentary Party candidate, and he wanted to opt out of the election because, as he said himself, he would find it moral torture to have to, as a favour, solicit votes for his election. And that sums up the mentality of people who hadn't had to contest elections for decades. But what you had on the part of Sinn Féin are very vigorous, active supporters who are enjoying the idea as well of rejecting the values and practices of their parents and the previous generation. And there was also an awful lot of attention given to it. This is strategic. It's organised. These people are, you know, corralled, and they're told what they should be doing to maximise the vote and where they should be going and who they should be targeting. And it's, you know, there are parts of the country during the 1918 election that are very quiet because so many of the constituencies were not contested. But that also means people from the quiet parts of the country can go up to the areas where the election is being contested. And there was also violence, and there was impersonation, and there was drunkenness, and, you know, there was, for some people, this is an almost carnival atmosphere.
Mary, Sinn Féin put forward just two women to stand in the election. One we hear a lot about, the successful candidate Contes Markievicz. The other, the wonderful but unfortunate Winifred Kearney, we hear very little about. Tell us about Winifred Kearney.
Well, Winifred Kearney had been around both nationalist and separatist politics, industrial relations through the trade unions and suffragism. So she'd been very active since her late teens, and she was a really excellent candidate, but she did not get the support of the party. She stood in a difficult constituency in Belfast, where it was the Victoria constituency, which was very strongly unionist. Yeah. Yes. But she did say afterwards, she was very disappointed that the machine that Dermot has been talking about here, it wasn't put to the benefit of her campaign at all. I mean, she said she had a couple of visits from Father O'Flanagan, who was the vice chair of the party at that stage, and one from Sean T. O'Kelly, and that was it. She had no workers other than trade union and suffrage women who came forward to give her backing, and really she had no machine at all. And she polled 395 votes, and she did say herself it was extraordinary that she got 395 votes, because obviously those people, something like the man in Donegal, they hadn't been asked directly because there had been no machine. They had taken it upon themselves to vote for what she stood for, which was a workers' republic.
And interestingly, was she run by Sinn Féin? She was far more Labour background than Sinn Féin background. Was this guilt on the part of the Sinn Féin organisation because one of the slogans of the election was Labour must wait? Now, Winifred Kearney would have been, you know, you would have expected she would be standing as a Labour candidate. And was she basically just, was this ticking a box of some kind?
It probably was. I haven't found any direct evidence to say that they sat down and plotted it, but they did actually try to suggest that both she and Markievicz, you know, that it mightn't be quite legal even to put two women forward, you know, so that there was a lot of vacillation even about having two candidates out of the 100 plus. So the thing about Kearney, I think, is that she would have insisted on standing for Sinn Féin because she wanted to underline the connection between Sinn Féin and Connolly's version of what would come, that this kind of state that would follow the election. Of course, it took a lot more than just the election, as we know, but she was very clear about her vision for the future, and she didn't really compromise on that in the least in her election approach.
Jeremy, talk to us a little bit about the North, because bar Redmond in Waterford, all of the successful, there were five other successful candidates in Northern constituencies, Joe Devlin being one of them. But I think most of the other ones were dubious, to put it mildly. There were arrangements, weren't there?
Well, there had to be arrangements as they saw it, because the danger for Sinn Féin and the Irish Parliamentary Party was that they would eat up each other's vote and thereby make it too easy for the unionists. And there was a compromise that was brokered by Cardinal Michael Logue. Now, this is a very interesting development, because for unionist critics, this was proof, of course, that home rule would mean Rome rule. Here we have these senior Catholic figures interfering in the electoral process. And Father Michael O'Flanagan, who was mentioned earlier on, was also seen as evidence of that. But the idea is that they would carve up the constituencies between them, Sinn Féin and the Irish Parliamentary Party. And that was quite successful. The Irish Parliamentary Party did well, relatively speaking, compared to the rest of the country in Ulster because of that arrangement, but also because they had a longer history there of contesting elections. And as Cardinal Logue saw it at that time, it was crucial to try and ensure that there was peace, relative peace, between Sinn Féin and the Irish Parliamentary Party in Ulster, whatever about the rest of the country where those kind of arrangements were not needed. But it was seized upon not just by Edward Carson, the senior Ulster unionist, but also by David Lloyd George, as, you know, a perfect example of the problems of clerical interference with politics.
Elaine, you've researched the Sinn Féin campaign, the campaign methods, propaganda, advertising. Did it in any way resemble a modern election campaign?
It is actually the dawn of modern electioneering, and all parties borrowed from propaganda campaigns for the Great War and emulated some of those. But it was also consumer advertising coming in during this time. It was the era of the department store, so a lot of commercial advertising methods were used. Sinn Féin and unionists were probably the most successful in terms of the array of propaganda techniques they used, from what we'd expect in terms of speeches. All parties were doing that, but they were using flags and banners to decorate cities and towns, and they were using poster campaigns across the nation, as were unionists as well in their areas. So yes, they were getting very modern.
And you can see them targeting specific constituencies in their publications as well. I mean, you know, Sinn Féin publishes an appeal to Irish women, and it publishes pamphlets on Sinn Féin and the labour question, and, you know, targeting, and even for farmers, you know, that your vote is safe if it's cast for Sinn Féin, you know, and your future is safe if you vote for Sinn Féin, that they are identifying key constituencies that they need to go after and tailoring their message accordingly.
Now, as we've already discussed, the Labour Party didn't participate in the election, allowing the people to decide between the home rule nationalism of the Irish Parliamentary Party and the more radical nationalism of Sinn Féin. And this raises the question, could the Labour Party have built on their achievements during the 1918 anti-conscription campaign in this election? And the IRA veteran Pather O'Donnell recalls his disappointment at their failure to do so.
My real impatience with them was when they went onto the sidelines in the 1918 election. De Valera said Labour must wait, but the trade union movement could have said that Connolly had purchased a place for them in the leadership of the independence movement, and they could have got a quota of TDs into the Republican Dáil, and in that way there would have been a clearly discernible working class factor in the leadership of the independent movement.
Jimmy, what about the point that O'Donnell makes there? Whatever about the anti-conscription campaign, where obviously they would have gained an element of kudos, that Connolly had purchased a place for them in the leadership of the independence movement.
Oh, this is a really difficult time for the Labour Party and the Labour movement. And there's no doubt if the Labour Party had run candidates in the 1918 election, they would have taken votes away from Sinn Féin. They're under huge pressure not to do that. And Aidha Blackham actually authors this piece on Sinn Féin and the labour question, and he says the labour movement is erroneous in its appeal to the workers as a class. The workers are not a class, they're part of the nation, and Sinn Féin stands for the nation. So they're getting it in the neck in that way. And De Valera also says, of course, that we cannot get distracted by side issues. this is another version of the Labour must wait. We'll deal with those issues. The Labour Party comes together with a special conference, and this was even after it had devised a programme for the election. So, I mean, there were those in the party who were adamant that they needed to contest it, but they had a special conference, and there was a vote, 96 votes to 29 in favour of not contesting the election. Thomas Johnson, the Labour Party leader at the time, was again in a very difficult position, as was William O'Brien, a leading trade unionist, because his argument was that maybe we need to focus on building up the trade union movement, on unionisation, rather than the political party at this stage. So there's a lot of divided opinion. But Labour figures also shared platforms with Sinn Féin during the election. So they did get involved in that way. But there's no doubt that they would have taken votes away from Sinn Féin and then would have been accused of preventing national unity.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be continuing our discussion on the general election of 1918. Welcome back to The History Show. We're spending the hour talking about the general election, the pivotal general election of 1918. My guests are Elaine Callanan, Diarmaid Ferriter and Mary Muldowney. Elaine, Sinn Féin's policy was of abstention from Westminster. But did they campaign on that promise? Did they talk in their election manifesto, in their election advertising, about Dáil-Éireann?
They did in a vague, roundabout sort of way. There was no real concrete decision about setting or like what kind of parliament was going to be set up after this idea of abstention from Westminster came to pass. It was all a little bit vague in terms of what they meant even by abstention from Westminster. It was an idea. It was an abstract. Once they had abstained from Westminster, then of course they were going to appeal to the Paris Peace Conference because of what Woodrow Wilson was saying. And after that, nobody really knew what was going to happen. The only other thing that they were really talking about, and then it would depend on what constituencies they were in, was this idea of a republic of some description. What they even meant by that was also a little bit vague in terms of their messages.
It was very revealing that Father Michael O'Flanagan was reputed to have said at the end of the election...
He was the Vice President of Sinn Féin.
He was the Vice President of Sinn Féin, and he was reputed to have said after the election, the people have voted Sinn Féin. Now what we have to do is explain what Sinn Féin is. And if he's saying that at the end of the election, that would suggest we have to be very careful of retrospectively deciding that there was clarity. There wasn't clarity. You're absolutely right. There was an awful lot of vagueness. Even the Sinn Féin election manifesto, you know, that they are talking about a commitment to render impotent the power of Britain to hold Ireland in subjection and to use any means necessary. What precisely that meant was not clear. I mean, that clearly can be interpreted in different ways.
But, I mean, was it the Dáil-Éireann not the logical conclusion of abstentionism? Going right back to the 1880s, when there were suggestions within the Parnellite movement in the 1880s that they might leave Westminster and they might come back and they might establish their own assembly of some kind. It's already out there.
It's the logical extension. Of course, Arthur Griffith was very much associated with that idea. That was the putting into practice of his political theory, very much. The difficulty is, what kind of an election was this and what was the British government's attitude to Sinn Féin at that time, and how public were they going to be as an organisation that is not being recognised as a legitimate one by Britain? How public are they going to be about their plans and have they got them worked out yet? It seems to me that that attention to detail comes in December and into early January. You know, from a strategic point of view, I don't think they were going to be enunciating their specific plans for the convening of an Irish Parliament.
Mary, women's suffrage faced some strong opposition, certainly wasn't assisted or helped in any way by the Irish Parliamentary Party and John Redmond, you know, back in 1913, for example, when he could have. And there must have been fears amongst members of the Irish Parliamentary Party that there would be a reckoning in 1918 from women. But did they in any way go after women? Votes.
I mean, Sinn Féin actually said, vote as you think Mrs. Pearce would have, which was still a bit patronising. But the Irish Parliamentary Party, I don't think, really understood the extent of the power that women might have, but because they had always put ladies not admitted to their public meetings, and they stopped doing that. But that seems to be about the extent of it. Sinn Féin was much more perhaps cynical in their approach to women, in that they were very much keeping them on side. They wanted them as speakers at public meetings, especially at hustings. But at the same time, as you said, Griffiths was opposing the extension of the franchise coming up to 22. Now, I know it's a couple of years later, but in 1919, You have both Labour and women being sidelined, Labour by their own choice, but a shape of the different kind of republic that might have come out of the potential of what was being proclaimed in 1916 had really been argued away when the democratic programme wasn't adopted. Mm. So I think that's where you start to see the movement away, and it became then what Connolly might have warned about. You know, the hang on to your guns, guys. You
It's another weakness of the Irish Parliamentary Party, isn't it? Its hostility to women, and John Dillon in particular, who was very vociferous in his opposition to female suffrage. And of course, he has to take over from John Redmond after Redmond's death in March 1918. And you can see in his private correspondence how he's really struggling to counteract the Sinn Féin threat and the Sinn Féin dominance. And he's dealing with an organisation that's really become flabby. There isn't a united leadership. And he regards a lot of his colleagues as betraying him by not having the courage or the resilience for the fight. And add into that the hostility to women. It's another indication that the Irish Parliamentary Party is not equipped to deal with Ireland in 1918.
Elaine, candidate selection, right? Sinn Féin, did they look to appoint candidates who had taken part in the Rising wherever possible, or German plot prisoners who had been incarcerated after the conscription crisis of 1918, which were frequently one and the same, obviously?
Yeah, well, actually, the answer is both. They aspired to have a candidate that had some connection with the Easter Rising when possible, but when that wasn't possible, anybody with kind of public separatist tendencies could slip in instead. The aim, of course, was to take away the idea of the Easter Rising in terms of its radical elements and begin to politicise themselves in terms of parliamentarianism at this stage. But yet they want to hold on to the romance, if you like, of the Easter Rising and use it as part of their electoral propaganda. Of course, they came under huge criticism from the Irish Party for so doing, both in terms of referring to the Easter Rising and, you know, by arguing that the Easter Rising saved Ireland from conscription, when in fact it had been Home Rule and Irish Party debates in the House of Commons that had saved Ireland from conscription. But their candidates are primarily Easter Rising candidates where possible. Mm-hmm. And that's the difficulty that the Irish Parliamentary Party face, because, of course, they're using candidates that have stood in the past, but they face a huge amount of retiring MPs, or MPs are stepping away. It's a bit akin, actually, to the 2011 general election. There's an awful lot of similarities in terms of that. So they scramble to try and replace those MPs. And that's the reason as well. It's not so much that Sinn Féin are incredibly strong in the uncontested constituencies, is that there just isn't enough time to scramble together to get Irish Parliamentary Party MPs.
There is a panic snobbery there that you can see in some of the final correspondence of John Redmond before he dies, when he talks about the failure of the party to unite around him. And he says, if we don't get our act together, the result will be universal anarchy, when every blackguard who wants to commit an outrage will simply call himself a Sinn Féiner and thereby get the sympathy of the unthinking crowd. I think about that phrase. Mm. I want to suggest about the relationship between John Redmond and some of the senior Irish Parliamentary Party figures and the electorate, because these were not dupes. These were very young, purposeful and informed and focused voters, and they're being dismissed in that quite contemptuous way. But there's also then the amount of candidates that were in jail, the amount of Sinn Féin candidates that were in jail, I think the figure was 36. You know, this is a very unusual election for that reason also.
But they put it into their campaign as well, like Eamon de Valera, a felon of our land. Yeah. Now, they're not criticising him for being a felon, they're actually kind of promoting the fact that he's a felon.
And he stands in four different constituencies.
Let's hear from the man himself, because as you say, many Sinn Féin candidates, 36, unable to actively campaign because they were in prison. We're going to hear now from Eamon de Valera. This didn't prevent him from hearing the good news when the election results were announced.
A number of those who had been elected as Sinn Féin candidates were unfortunately not able to come. There were, when their names were called out, the reply was, "Fair glass a galif." They were under lock and key by the foreigner. I was one of these. I was in Lincoln at the time, and I know with what joy we heard of the results of the elections, and it was a great joy to know that the Irish people had ratified the action of the men of 1916.
The voice there of Eamon de Valera, successful candidate. One of the candidates who was imprisoned during the election campaign was Terence McSweeney, who was candidate in the constituency of Mid Cork. We're going to hear now from Niall Murray. He's an independent historian who focuses on the Irish Revolution. He's part of a curating team at Independence Museum Kilmurry in County Cork. Niall has been researching the election in Mid Cork. Earlier, he spoke to Lorcan Clancy.
When Ireland finally went to the polls in 1918 for the first general election in 8 years, the Sinn Féin candidate for Mid Cork had an impeccable Republican pedigree.
Most famously known for being the Lord Mayor of Cork, who died on a hunger strike in 1920, his association with nationalist politics in Cork and in Ireland went back really to the early 1900s.
Born in 1879 in Cork City, Terence McSweeney was involved in many of the cultural nationalist organisations, like Conradh na Gaeilge.
Very active in the Irish language movement. He was also an artist, best known in his time as a playwright. He was involved in setting up the Cork Dramatic Society around 1909-1910, producing a lot of plays in the local theatres in Cork City, many of them based on the old Celtic myths and with a strong nationalist theme running through them.
McSweeney and others from the Cork Volunteers were arrested in May 1916 after the Rising, and he spent much of the rest of his life in custody.
So he was a long-standing advanced nationalist in Cork City, well known to the people of Cork, but also to many of the big names in Sinn Féin and Irish Volunteers in Dublin as well.
McSweeney was interned at Lincoln Jail when he learned of his nomination. While he could receive correspondence there and was free to write home, he could not discuss political matters in his own letters.
So it was mostly family matters with which he was concerned in his letters home to his wife Muriel and often to his sisters Mary and Annie, who were both strong Cumann na mBan activists. Shortly after the war ended and the election was caused, he did get a letter from the man chosen to be his election agent in the constituency, a Macroom solicitor called Jeremiah J. Creed. Mr. Creed said that any opposition is not expected, but your return is a foregone conclusion.
Though opposition wasn't expected in Mid Cork, the local Sinn Féin party didn't know for sure whether or not there'd be a contest until nominations closed on the 4th of December.
So they were still ready, geared up and ready for an election campaign in Mid Cork.
Preparations were made for the Irish Volunteers to support the Sinn Féin campaign, as they had in recent by-elections around Ireland.
They drafted in volunteer companies from really around the country. You hear of men from Cork and Waterford travelling to East Clare and even to Longford during those by-elections. They would have been, let's say, lending their weight to those Sinn Féin canvassers who were going and knocking on doors or addressing rallies, particularly difficult when the candidate himself, like in many other constituencies, was not there to deliver speeches himself.
McSweeney, under lock and key, was one of those who couldn't deliver speeches himself, but he asked the local Sinn Féin committee to give an address on his behalf.
There's actually, in the current exhibition at the Cork Public Museum, there is a large bill poster of such an address that was issued on his behalf. Now, they don't seem to have followed his instruction that it should be in Irish. His supporters on the ground cite him as a strong patriot, comparing him to Pádraig Pearse, who believes that the root of Ireland's trouble lies in English domination and that under a free Ireland, the claims of the working classes would receive due recognition.
Since 1901, the Mid Cork constituency had been represented by D.D. Sheehan.
It was initially a parliamentary party, an Irish Party MP, but like many politicians, particularly in Cork, he in 1909 joined the renegade parliamentarian William O'Brien's new All for Ireland League. There was a strong tradition of political activism in Mid Cork, and the All for Ireland League actually held most of the Cork constituencies in the 1910 election. The All for Ireland League depended largely on the support of organised labour in County Cork. They were very much tied to the labour movement, and in fact it was in 1915 when Terence McSweeney began organising the Irish Volunteers in County Cork on a full-time basis that he very much tapped on the shoulders of local All for Ireland and labour people.
The incumbent MP D.D. Sheehan had faded from political life in Mid Cork. After the outbreak of World War I, he had enlisted in the British Army.
He was a man in his early 40s by the time the war broke out, but he enlisted and was in action as initially as a recruiting officer around Munster for the Royal Munster Fusiliers, before then actually being sent to Europe, and he was actually an officer in France for a period in the war. He lost a couple of sons in the war himself, and by the time 1918 came around, believe it or not, he actually stood for election as a Labour candidate in one of the boroughs near London. So really, there was little or no question that he would be on the ballot paper for the Parliamentary Party or for the All for Ireland League.
Because of the runaway growth of Sinn Féin, many Irish Parliamentary Party MPs bowed out of the race as the vote approached.
They really started to drop like flies in the weeks before the election itself took place, declaring themselves unavailable or deciding to make way or deciding that their time had been served. They very much saw themselves as having a losing battle if they were to stand in the election, and that was no different in Mid Cork, where McSweeney was put forward by Sinn Féin.
But in Mid Cork, there was some talk of challenging McSweeney.
There's a report of the Macroom Board of Guardians meeting in late November and asking disparaging questions about who is this chap McSweeney and from the city who's been nominated. They pretended nobody had ever heard of him, but in fact he would have been well known in the area due to his organising work for the Irish Volunteers and other such efforts.
One name suggested was William Fallon from Dublin. He had run in Mid Cork back in 1910 and got 40% of the vote. There were calls for him to stand again for the Irish Party, but he wrote a long letter published in the Cork Examiner explaining why he wouldn't.
He talked about the people of Ireland being too angry and there being too much protest for people to see reason, and he felt that the Irish Parliamentary Party needed some younger, fresher invigoration, that the youth of the country had been overtaken by the Sinn Féin movement, and also that he didn't see that Ireland could secure any international support for its independence claim. And he declared that rather than ask his old friends in Mid Cork for their support, I am content to wait until I am sent for later on. So he seems to be playing the hero and saying, I'll be ready when you want me.
As nominations closed on Wednesday the 4th of December, there were no other candidates, meaning McSweeney would be returned unopposed.
Rather than wait for the counting of votes in all the constituencies, which didn't happen until the end of December, there were celebrations not alone in Macroom, but also in Kilmurry, which was the parish where his election agent John T. Murphy hailed from, and there were processions in Macroom and Kilmurry that night.
Over a week later, McSweeney wrote home to his sisters and managed to get a reference to his success past the postal censors.
In his first reference, really, to the election, he said, "All of us here were delighted with the good news of last Wednesday's promising start. As you say, of course, it's not the men, but the cause that's winning." I suppose Mid Cork is a good case study of what was happening around the country in many parts, sending a message that constitutional parliamentary politics of the Irish Parliamentary Party, which had dominated for decades, it was soon going to be a thing of the past.
McSweeney was released in time for the second meeting of Dáil Éireann in April of 1919. He was arrested again in August 1920, by which time he'd also been elected Lord Mayor of Cork.
And after a 74-day hunger strike, most of which was spent in Brixton Prison in London, he died on the 25th of October 1920.
Lorcan Clancy was reporting there. He was speaking to Niall Murray about the candidacy of Terence McSweeney in the Mid-Cork constituency in that general election of 1918. And Niall, as I mentioned, is part of the curating team at the Independence Museum Kilmurry in Cork, which has a large collection of items which belonged to or are associated with Terence McSweeney. It's well worth a visit. Chairman, the volunteers, the Irish volunteers, did they play much of a role in the election campaign?
Well, they certainly did, and they were very much encouraged to do so. They were involved in canvassing and in stewarding and in wielding sticks and other weapons in order to counteract the competing groups. I mean, there were very ugly episodes associated with this election, because inevitably tensions were very high. You'll often hear reference to the ancient order of Hibernians, which was obviously associated with a different political affiliation. The separation allowance women are often mentioned. These were the wives of the servicemen, now in some cases the ex-servicemen at the end of the First World War, who had very strong feelings and were often supported in their protests by local notables, supporters of the Irish Parliamentary Party. So the volunteers are very much involved in that. And it's not all negative. You know, it's also about them mobilising for a very fixed purpose, and they feel they are part of something new and that they are going to be playing their role in the inauguration of a new era, of a new phase. So for a lot of them, it's a very positive and a very affirming experience.
And Mary, what about coming them on?
Well, they played an extremely important role, and it was recognised by Sinn Féin that they could play that important role, but of course they were auxiliaries to the volunteers, and there was a determination that even at that stage they weren't going to get out of that position. But there were women within the movement. There was the Cumann na Dochtaí, for instance, who had been formed earlier in 1918, who wanted to demand a more active role for women and for women candidates to be put forward. The Irish Women's Franchise League, in their analysis afterwards, specifically identified the absence of a list being put forward of women. But the trouble was that they didn't have a representative on the executive, and while they did have people in Sinn Féin, they were very concerned about what had happened, say, with the Ladies Land League at the end of the 19th century, when they agreed then to put women's issues aside, something like the Labour Party deciding that Labour could wait. It was a mistake at that stage, but hindsight is wonderful.
Elaine, it was a drawn-out affair. The election itself took place over a couple of days. The count seemed to take forever. But what kind of things were happening at the polls? Did we see much evidence of vote early, vote often, or the vote of the Fenian dead, that kind of thing?
You did, but I think it's important to remember this was a kind of an all-Ireland election, and like Sinn Féin were not the only people at the polling stations. The Irish Party would have had their volunteers, Unionists would have had their volunteers. And there's actually some witty things happen during that time as well. At one polling station, the Irish Parliamentary Party side had a sing-off of ballads against the Sinn Féin side, and whoever sang the best ballad, there was great applause by both until the results came through. There was also personation at the ballot box, you know, where people cast quite a number of votes. There was one person in Leitrim, I think his name is Eamon Kilkenny, I could be corrected on that now, and he claimed that he casted 50 votes in favour of Sinn Féin. Now, there's evidence of the Irish Party doing that as well, and there's evidence of Unionists doing that also. So I would say that they probably cancelled each other out in terms of impersonating votes.
And Diarmaid, the importance of, the significance of the first past the post system, because it's obviously something we're not used to in Irish general elections, but that was the case here at least.
Well, that's hugely important. And if you break down the figures, Sinn Féin effectively won three quarters of the seats with just under half of the votes. And the reason that was possible was because of the first past the post system. Now, Sinn Féin, under proportional representation, you know, would have done very well anyway, but it wouldn't have been quite as emphatic. And much, much later in 1950, Ernest Blythe makes the case for the abolition of proportional representation in Irish elections. And he references 1918 by saying, if proportional representation had been in existence for the 1918 general election, Sinn Féin would not have got that vote for national unity, as he put it at the time. So it's used in that way at a much later stage when people are making the case for its abolition. And if you consider the fate of the Irish Parliamentary Party, what difference would proportional representation have meant for that party? Well, the Irish Parliamentary Party, in percentage terms, does respectably. You know, again, when you break down the figures, you're talking about a vote of over 20%. So, you know, if they had been awarded proportionately,
they would have got 21 seats.
They would have done a hell of a lot better than six, which is what they got. So, you know, when you break it down like that, it is significant. Though, interestingly, the reason why Britain decided to experiment with proportional representation in Ireland during the War of Independence was actually to try precisely to break the dominance of the Sinn Féin vote. And it didn't work out that way because Sinn Féin learned how to use proportional representation very effectively. And of course, the Irish went on to embrace it. There were attempts in the 50s and the 60s to get rid of it by Fianna Fáil, and the Irish electors was having none of it.
Absolutely, yeah. We're going to take another quick break. We'll be back to continue our discussion on the general election of 1918 after these.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to The History Show. We're talking about the 1918 general election. My guests are Elaine Callanan, Diarmaid Farriter and Mary Muldowney. We're going again now to Professor Liam O'Brien, who was Sinn Féin candidate in the constituency of Mid Armagh. And he lost there to a unionist candidate by 3,000 votes. He spoke on RTE Radio years later about the effect of the election on the country.
Really, looking back on it, I think it's true enough to say that with the election of 1918, with that victory and with up to 73 members not going, refusing to go to Westminster, the bottom was knocked out of the Act of Union and a new era for Ireland was simply bound to happen. From the meeting of the Dáil onwards, there was a great change in the feeling of the country. We now had a government and people began to develop a marvellous feeling, thing impossible to realise now, I think, at all, that we had a government of our own, that a government had been proclaimed. Every volunteer took on a different feeling, so to speak. He was now a soldier of an established government. He was not a rebel. He was not a desperate minority who were fighting against overwhelming odds, but he had the backing of the, what to him was the legal government of the country behind him. People felt the same thing all round. Nobody dared criticise the Dáil or any TD in it. You see, they were all sacrosanct personages, a bit different from nowadays.
A bit different from nowadays, indeed. Elaine, the results of the election took some time to come out. It was basically a couple of weeks. And those results showed what? It was what, Sinn Féin, 47% of the vote, but 73 seats, wasn't it?
73 seats. It showed actually a number of different things. It showed, like newspapers reported at the time, on not only who won in various different constituencies, but they also talked a little bit about how people voted and what sorts of contests they were. And just to give you a for example, like one of the things that they talked about was the amount of women that turned out on election day to cast their votes. So I think the fact that both Sinn Féin and Unionists did appeal to women in terms of their electioneering at the time actually paid at the polls. And certainly that's across all of the newspapers, whether they're national or whether they are provincial newspapers.
And Mary, we heard about Winifred Kearney, 395 votes. I think it was something like 4% of the poll. And she was happy to get 4% of the poll, given the amount of support she got. But what about the Countess? The Countess did rather better.
She did indeed, yes. I think she got about 66% of the vote in St. Patrick's in Dublin. But she had the whole machine behind her. And not to take away from that particular achievement, but as again the Irish Women Franchise League put it into perspective, they said we got one woman for more than half of the population. So it wasn't exactly a resounding victory, but in the circumstances,
I think that there was some very negative commentary on the idea of Constance Markievicz being in that position. The Irish Independent editorialised that she was lacking the mental balance necessary for the position.
Well, obviously, Dev did not take that to heart because he appoints her as his Minister for Labour and proudly pointed to the fact that he was the first person ever to have appointed a woman to the Cabinet. And the next woman that was appointed to the Cabinet was 1979, 60 years later, Maura Geoghegan Quinn. So it was significant.
But it wasn't clear after the election that there would be a Cabinet. And that's the interesting thing. You know, it wasn't clear what was going to happen next. And there would have been a degree of trepidation as to what was going to happen next and what were they going to do with this mandate. What is indisputable, I think, is the extent of the mandate that is there after that election. And that does inaugurate a new phase. In a sense, the 1918 election is the culmination of something, but also the beginning of something. Yeah. It's a culmination of a lot that's happened, obviously, since the 1916 rising, but it's also the beginning of what becomes a political war of independence and also, of course, a military war of independence.
And what about the Labour Party? I'll ask you a what-if question, which is something you'd be well used to from your broadcasting career. Labour's decision not to contest the election, how did that affect their election prospects thereafter, do you think?
Well, there was a narrative that I was used to when I was studying history as an undergraduate, was that this was a great missed opportunity because it was such a defining election that it did terrible damage to the Labour Party. I'm not so convinced of that anymore, because if you look at the Labour Party's performance in 1922 in the general election of June 1922, the Labour Party does really, really well. And it has to...
Run enough candidates.
No, it didn't run enough candidates, but I mean, it ran 18 candidates and 17 of them were elected, but it indicated that there was a clear political appetite for its message, but also for issues above and aside from the treaty. The difficulty for the Labour Party, I think, is the Civil War. It's not so much 1918, because again, they get sidelined, they get lost in what becomes such a visceral competition between the pro and anti-treaty Sinn Féin sides, and they get squeezed. And I think that's the real problem, as opposed to 1918.
Agree, disagree?
No, I agree, actually, because if you don't even go to general elections, if you look at the 1920 local elections, you will see that Labour fielded quite a number of candidates and did very well.
And gave Sinn Féin a bit of a scare.
And gave Sinn Féin a bit of a scare. So I would agree with Dermot. I don't think that the 1918 general election caused Labour any harm. I think that does come slightly later. But I also think that they were very focused as well on establishing trade union movements the length and breadth of the country. They were also collecting strike funds. They were taking money for other issues as well. So they couldn't really go back and tap that same resource again for election funds, unlike some of the other political parties.
But of course, we're entering another very important period in the decade of centenaries, as January will, of course, see the 100th anniversary of the first Dáil Éireann and also the first shots fired in the War of Independence, coincidentally or otherwise, happening on the same day. This election, truly though, 1918, was a watershed moment in Irish history and a defining act of national self-determination. Elaine Cannonan, Dermot Ferriter and Mary Muldowney, thank you all very much indeed for joining us. That's all we've got time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items as well as podcasts are available on our website, rte.ie/history. My thanks tonight to Ruth Kennington on sound and our researcher Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.